Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. So glad you could join us tonight. The solar wind is 401 kilometers per second. Very nice day in the sunshine. Six sunspot clusters active on the sun today. NOAA forecasters estimate a 60% chance of polar geomagnetic storms today. CME, that's a coronal mass ejection, is expected to hit Earth's magnetic field sometime today. The incoming cloud was propelled from the sun by an erupting magnetic filament on the 8th, about 3 days ago. If you live in high latitudes, be aware of auroras coming tonight. Tonight is the peak of the Perseid meteor shower. Should be able to see some very healthy fireballs tonight. Should see anywhere between 10 and 50 per hour. So it could be a really productive night. If you have a time-elapsed photograph ability, you might want to set up your camera on a tripod, point it at the North Star, otherwise you're going to get a bunch of starry streaks across the sky because the sun, the Earth is rotating. Not too much going on in the news today. I wish there was, because I would have a more dynamic program for you today. Our phone lines are open, 888-429-5471. The conference line will be open in about 1 or 2 minutes. If you are a regular listener, you know what that number is. If you're not, it is 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000. When you get there, put in the passcode 769-608-POUND, 769-608-POUND. That will allow you to listen to the program while you're walking around using your cell phone. All in all, a pretty peaceful August everywhere, except that in the last 4 days, there have been 15 assassinations using drones overseas. Interesting, looks like a chess game going on over there where some credible and specific threats were made, and in response, the United States closed a couple of dozen embassies across the Middle East, warning Americans not to travel, etc. Shortly after the 15 assassinations in Yemen, most of those embassies were reopened, and I'm sure sometime in the news in the next few days we'll hear some kind of claim that that strategy worked in heading off some kind of terror attack. Just like I said, interesting chess game going on out there. The sun, as you know, about every 11 years, it changes its polarity. That is to say, the North Pole becomes the South and the South becomes the North. Not physically. I mean, the sun doesn't actually turn over or change rotation, but the magnetic alignment of the star changes. And that during that process, there can be, you know, many electromagnetic effects on the planets in the solar system. Now, the interesting thing about this is 11 years ago when this occurred, we were not the electronic society we are today. A few people had cell phones. Some cell connections were out there. We were using them. Wasn't the network that we have today. We didn't have smartphones. We didn't have iPads. There weren't the kind of data connection that we have today. There was no texting. None of that was going on back then. So now, we are a society that is intricately tied together electronically. We instantly send messages back and forth. And the interesting thing about it is that there's some kind of unwritten protocol that has arisen out of it. In other words, if you send a text to someone, the unwritten protocol is that you respond, you know, whether you're driving or whether whatever it is you're doing, you respond to that text, LOL, K, or whatever the message might be. It's a little different than phone calling. It's one of those kinds of things where you could almost simultaneously have several text connections going on at the same time. And the ability with most phones now to be able to send photos, video, files, all kinds of things via the text system, it has created an entire subculture inside of our culture. Interesting stuff. Hold on 1 second while I take a sip of my wonderful grapefruit juice. Ah, wonderful. And that subculture, it's funny because when systems like this are implemented or put into place, they're just kind of laid into our hands. Okay, here you are, dumb, stupid public. Here's your capability. No user manual, no guidelines, no laws, no restrictions. Go. And society will, in very short order, and maybe we have been conditioned now to the short order nature of the change in technology. And that in and of itself has become a sociological phenomenon for society. Now, the phenomenon changes as it goes from culture to culture. I will tell you that in Japan, this culture already blossomed. It already came up out of the ground, blossomed, gave forth fruit, and it reproduced and did its thing. Now, when that technology was brought to the United States, it did the same thing, but it did it in a different way because our culture is different. The way we communicate, the things that we expect from each other in terms of communication, in terms of how private or how public that communication is, and it is stratified demographically. That is to say, people that I know that are over 70 are texting where 10 years ago, if you handed them a smartphone, they'd have said, what do I do with this? Do I talk on it? Now, people over 70 are texting back and forth and connecting. People between, I'm going to say, 45 and 70 have taken this to, well, an entire connectivity has emerged because of it. And we are seeing that play out in the sociology of humankind. All kinds of relationships that absolutely would never have happened 10 years ago are now possible. Across states, between countries, between age groups, even between languages. And people are not only communicating, they're meeting, they're falling in love, they're marrying, they're leaving marriages, they're all kinds of sociological effects are occurring. So this is the kind of thing that we would see if over a period of time, over a period of generations. Now it's occurring in a period of months or perhaps even a year or two. Now, the real phenomenon is the under 45 age group. And I'm going to take this all the way down to, say, age 11 or 12. That's about the age when average age when parents are actually giving a smartphone to their kids. Why did they do that? Because they want to see their kids on the phone all the time? No, because they want to be connected to their kids. They want to be able to find them. They want to be able to talk to them. And even more importantly, they want their kids to be able to find home. If something goes wrong, if some emergency comes up, if some schedule changes, or someone gets hurt, or someone needs something, then that connectivity is there. It's far better than, you know, a help button that a kid can press that brings unwanted costs and liabilities by summoning police or fire or whatever. They can simply text home. They can send home. And some of these phones have GPS capabilities so that when they are in the backpack or in the shirt pocket or in the jacket of a youngster, if need be, a parent can find a child by going to police and saying, yes, here's my child's cell phone number, and they can simply pull that cell phone up. It has GPS capability, and they can go right to it. So as I said, the entire culture has changed. It has become a part of our subculture, has become a part of our moray in our sociological makeup. And that is so interesting. Now, the fact that this is all tied together, and that our society on an emotional level, on a technological level, on a communicative level, is tied together using this electronics, it makes us, as a society, particularly vulnerable to outside interruptions in that society. In other words, it's a disaster if a grown-up loses their cell phone and they don't have it backed up somewhere. Oh my gosh, all those notes, all those addresses, those contacts. You know, in the old days, I say the old days, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we used a day timer. We used some kind of planner. We carried around like a little, you know, 12-ring Bible. And we would open it up, and it had our business cards, it had our passport in it, it had notes that we took throughout the day, it had plans, to-do lists, things that we made out. There was a whole industry that sprung up about this kind of management of one's time, one's efficiency. And as PDAs came about, these personal devices that allowed us to electronically make those schedules. Palm came out with one, and then that morphed, and then, you know, now it's all done by phone. And now, because of the innovators in the industry, that ability to plan and to accept planning from other people as they send you a schedule event, or they send you a conference call number, or make an appointment, or a contact, you can simply add it to your phone, 1-2 clicks, boom, it's done. And you can back all that up in the cloud, you can back it up on your laptop, you can back it up on another more safe, more stable peripheral at your home, and so it's not a disaster if you lose that cell phone. But it would be a tremendous disaster if the entire network were lost. Your phone, your laptop, the cloud, everything. Well, in an event that occurs every 11 years, the magnetic field of the sun will change its polarity in a matter of months. Not years, just months, according to new observations by NASA-supported observatories. And as you know, the Solar Dynamics Observatory, we call it the SDO, is now up there taking stereographic images of the sun in wavelengths that are, you know, visual, so that we can actually see what's going on in the sun. We've never had the capability before. We use the what's called SOHO, which is just an infrared chip. It doesn't really have, you know, imaging capabilities, although it does give us an image. It does not have the resolution to pick up something, say, planet size or ship size or anything like that. It doesn't have that kind of resolution. It just shows up as large pixels. But it will show us relative or analog data coming off the sun, like a magnetic filament or a CME. Although SOHO can't look at the surface of the sun, it actually has that portion blocked out by a piece of metal that sits between the detector and the sun. So it keeps that from actually picking up the sun's surface itself. It only looks at the corona of the sun. The SDO is capable of looking right at the sun up close and personal with a couple of different lenses, and it really gives us great, great perspective. Well, it looks like, at least now we're confirming, that that no more than 3 to 4 months from now, the poles of the sun are going to completely reverse. The change will, I don't say might, it will have ripple effects throughout the solar system. As the field shifts, the current sheet, that's a surface that radiates billions of kilometers outwards from the sun's equator, becomes very wavy. Picture it like sort of like Saturn's rings, although visually they're invisible, around the equator of the sun. The same thing with the Milky Way galaxy. The galaxy's center is theorized to have a supermassive spinning black hole. And by spinning, I mean it's spinning at the maximum speed that its mass will allow. The shape of that black hole is believed to change so that it kind of fattens up at the equator through just the centrifugal force, and the top and bottom sort of squish in so it looks more like a flying saucer than it does a spinning basketball or a black marble in space. And that gravitational sheet or plate that goes out is the gravitational line of demarcation upon which all the stars and the planets that revolve around those stars and all the free-floating stars and planets align themselves, and that's why the Milky Way galaxy looks like a giant spiral, and most galaxies do. Anyway, this plate, this sheet or skirt around the outside of the sun becomes very wavy. Now, that wave is where we are. NASA officials said Earth orbits the sun, dipping in and out of the waves of this current sheet. The transition from a wave to a dip can create stormy space weather around the Earth. How bad has that storm been in the past? Well, it has been disruptive. It has been measurable. But then again, we were not such a electronically connected sociology. In 2012 or 2002, when this first occurred, we had cell phones, but they had buttons on them. I mean, can you believe that? Buttons? And only in Japan did they have phones with video displays. Here we had LCD displays. You could get a two or three or four, 10 lines of text, and that was about it. There was no sending pictures. There was no even looking at pictures on your phone. That didn't exist here in the United States in 2002. It wasn't part of our society. Now it is. It's part of our core. It's part of our generation. Not just the 12-year-olds that are alive now that were being born in 2002, but I'm talking about the parents of those 12-year-olds, the grandparents of those 12-year-olds, have also changed their sociology to this electronic phenomenon. Now, while the polarity can stir up some stormy weather, it also provides extra shielding from dangerous cosmic rays. These high-energy particles that form or that smash into the upper atmosphere create effects in the upper atmosphere which generate other, sputter off other particles, and it sort of creates like a sort of like a traffic accident on the freeway at freeway speed with a semi full of ping pong balls or golf balls. You get the idea. It gets very difficult to drive a car through all these golf balls bouncing all around the freeway. Well, that's exactly what it's like up in the upper atmosphere. These particles, which are accelerated by events like the supernova explosions, except this is a solar phenomenon, zip through the universe at nearly the speed of light. They can harm satellites and astronauts if they're in space. And the wrinkled current sheet better protects the planet from these particles. It just coagulates them and forms kind of a a freeway full of golf balls. It just makes it very difficult for the super high-speed particles that are generated from these explosions to penetrate to Earth. Now, I don't know if there's ever been a supernova in space close enough to affect Earth at the same time that the sun was going through one of these polar shifts. But, there's always tomorrow. The effect of the rippled sheet can also be felt throughout the solar system, far beyond Pluto and even touching the Voyager probes near the barrier of interstellar space. The sun's north pole has already changed sign, while the south pole is racing to catch up. Soon, however, both poles will be reversed, and the second half of the solar maximum will be underway. We will have crossed the halfway point. The current solar maximum is the weakest in 100 years. And if you were to compare it to other solar maximums going back, well, as far as solar maximums have been or could have been even monitored. It is, to say the very least, lackluster, and we have not had the flare activity that we normally see from a solar maximum. There have been some flares, but they've been weak and they've been sporadic and they have not really delivered direct hits to the Earth. That being said, Earth needs a certain amount of solar flare activity. That ejection of charged particles to the Earth, we're not just talking about light, we're not just talking about photons, we're actually talking about protons that are charged up by the sun, hurled out of the corona of the sun in the direction of the blast. And whatever is in the way collects those protons. This is mass, physical mass that is received by various planets in the solar system. When Earth receives them, it builds up the upper atmosphere. It helps protect Earth from deeper and more high-energy cosmic radiation. Wow. Good pink grapefruit juice. Wow. Anyway, without the solar flares, eventually the Earth's atmosphere would weaken, would become more transparent, and the surface of the planet would be exposed to many more hazardous forms of radiation. UVC, which is the shortest wavelength of UV light that we actually call light, down in the low 300, high 200 nanometer range. This is often known in the industry as antiseptic UV light, in the sense that it will dimerize or split molecules that have a free radical in them. DNA is a good example. Creating free radicals in a system creates an extra electron on the end atom of a particle or an enzyme or a protein, and this makes it extremely reactive to other things. Normally, that reaction is with water or with the OH on the water. And it can create heat, and it can create new compounds, sometimes polymers. So that's just so you know how that's done. So this photodimerization occurs on the skin as this UV light as a person is exposed to this UV light. Can you be exposed to it? Yes, of course you can. Not for long periods, though, because it will eventually sunburn you severely. And there are some organs, for instance, the eyes, that you do not want to expose to this kind of UV because it will destroy the rods and cones in the eye. In other words, you will go blind. So, and any sensing organ in that kind of structure will be severely affected. And it will affect everything, insects, bacteria, especially bacteria, because they only have one cell and they have no nucleus. There's no way for them to protect themselves against this stuff. And so that's why you will see in operating rooms or other places where you want to have an antiseptic instrument like a comb or a pair of scissors or a razor or a knife or some other instrument, you want to constantly bathe it in this short wavelength UV called antiseptic ultraviolet light, and it will keep that instrument sterile because no living protein can stay together underneath that kind of light. UVB, mid 300 nanometer ultraviolet light will still burn the skin. It's not something that you want to be exposed to. It will eventually cause skin cancer, and it will severely damage and dry out, biological surfaces. Most animals can protect themselves against UVB, oils, hairs, different things like that on them. Humans don't have a whole lot of either one of those. We have a tendency to protect our skin with melanin, which is the black pigment in the skin. The skin will respond to sunlight by adding pigment to the skin, changing the color of the skin. We call it a suntan. Some races naturally have more of this in their skin, which makes them less susceptible, but they could still get sunburned, could still get damaged by this kind of light. So, but the electronic world is particularly sensitive, and honestly, we don't really know how sensitive. And it's not just our electronic gear, it's our electronic sociology that is affected. So, usually at the height of the solar maximum, it starts out at a minimum, goes up to a maximum, goes back down to a minimum, and then crosses over into the next solar cycle. We are now in solar cycle 24. It is usually the beginning of an end of it are marked by high latitude reverse polarity sunspots. That means that the sunspots are away from the equator, up toward the upper, the north or southern poles of the sun, and they're reverse polarized. So that's sort of the starting flag, I guess you want to call that, of a solar maximum. And solar cycle 24 was just a hard start. It just didn't have a whole lot of fuel in the tank. And now we've reached the 11-year point. The North Pole has already switched polarity, and the South Pole is in the process of doing that. And it should be all done and finished by December 21st. By the way, that kind of brings us to an interesting subject, and a lot of people have brought it up, written me about it, because we wrote four books on the subject of the advent of 2012, most of which was sparked by a discovery that Jose Arguez made in 1958, where the Mayan calendar was purported to end on December 21st, 2012. And when you take into consideration the tomb lid of Pakal, which was one of the ancient kings, one of the ancient Mayan kings, who was 7 feet tall, had 6 fingers, 6 toes, as did his son, that tomb lid had a sort of interpretive key of what happened the last time this occurred at the beginning of the calendar, and now we're back around to the beginning of the calendar, is going to occur again. Now, what does that mean? December 21st, 2012 passed without so much as a Y2K burp. A lot of people are saying, well, it wasn't really December of 2012. It was December of 2013 that should be the point of interest. That lines up with the complete polarity shift of the sun. It also lines up with some of the other things that we've been seeing in the local universe. The galactic plane, the alignment with the rift in the Milky Way, several things that seem to line up from a geological point of view are coming to fruition this year, not last year. Now, what does that mean? Oh, sorry, we were off by 12 months over a 1,500-year future look, and we apologize. The Mayan calendar maybe goes back, the last tweak to it, maybe 550 A.D. So some 1,500 years ago, a society had a mathematical interpretation of how to date, how to time things, and made some future predictions based upon that. Was it a shattering of the calendar or the creation, or was it a new beginning? Was it a new awakening? Hard to tell. Many, many pathways have been taken. If you read the Arc of Millions of Years series, it's about 1,500 pages. You're going to get everybody's viewpoint. And I don't mean the modern day prognosticators. I'm talking about the ancient civilizations that looked at this phenomenon. what it mean to them? How do they record it? How do they interpret the universe? Where do they think we came from? It was of deep concern to those societies, and so they made a big deal out of it, and they made all kinds of myths about it and religions about it, and they also left some records for us, both Babylonians, the Hittites, the Olmecs, the Mayans, the Zapotecs, and even the American Indians, Hopi not excluded, of course, made some predictions about what was going to come in, quote, the latter days. Modern day religions, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is certainly one of the more notable ones, have been formed or restored and have put what many would say back in place pieces that have been missing for a long, long time. Or if not missing, they've been like a library shelf that's been dumped off on the floor. It took somebody in connection with the creator, some would say, to reach down on the floor, take all the volumes and put them back on the shelf in the order in which they go. And as prophets are wont to do when they are speaking with God, not only are new words added, but old words are cleaned up, so to speak. They're not reinterpreted, but they're sort of like, hey, that's not what we meant in the old language. This is more closely to what we were actually trying to say. Those societies understood fine what we were trying to say, but because of a lack of the ability to read and write, they were unable to pass that along to us in our language or in a language we could understand, and so a prophet comes forward and makes those interpretations. Is this adding to or taking away from? Some would say yes, some would say no. One thing we do know about the Bible, which we look at as a book, but actually is a library. That's what Bible means. Biblio is not a book. It is a library. And anyone, any decent scholar of the Bible will see that the New Testament books are put together in order of size, not in any chronological order. And when you study them, whether you're in primary, early Sunday school, or whether you're an advanced scholar, it doesn't take much to figure out that there are pieces missing. And so when you get to the point where you have this roadmap, and the end is sort of described, the main roads are kind of there, but we can't really tell how they line up, it leaves it open to huge amount of interpretation. So one would say that there is a need for a prophet to come forth in the latter days to sort of restore the broken mirror to its one once fine, clean sheet so everyone can see what was really meant, why we are really here, what we're doing here, what our potential is, what are the ramifications of our activities and our thoughts and our deeds on this planet. There are a lot of schools of thought that tie into that, and I don't mean to digress. I am really tying this into the electric sociology that I'm talking about during this hour. This electric sociology has had the effect of tying our society together in across age groups, across race groups, and even across national groups. We are able to communicate with Egyptians and Chinese and Australians and Norwegians and Mexicans and Canadians all at the same time. That's what we're doing here tonight. We're live on global webcast radio, and people are listening to us from Missouri to Madagascar. And they're realizing that what I am saying right here is actually occurring in reality as time goes on. We have jumbled the demographic lines, the barriers between our society, and we are discovering things about ourselves as a race that transcend the laws, rules, mores, and guidelines that our governments have set out for us. And the most interesting effect that I see is that the powers that be, the powers that were, I guess, the old families that thought they ruled the whole world, that thought that they could tell money where it had to go and where it had to be spent and who was going to have it and who was going to be in control. It has frustrated the crap out of these people. The Bilderbergers and the quote-unquote Illuminati and all of that, they are losing their minds right now. Because, you know, one of the things you have to realize is that with great power in this society comes a great loss of privacy. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I could tell you right now, just like the kings of old had, you know, food tasters, you know, people that would sit beside them, and every time there was a big feast and they brought all the food out, you know, the fried turkey legs and the zucchinis and everything, when it hit the king's plate, the food taster took a bite out of it first. And then the king would observe the food taster. And if he didn't turn blue and fall over dead, it was okay for him to eat it. You know why that is? It wasn't because the king was hated. Well, not usually. It's because the king was envied. Not just his enemies, the people that worked with him. Nobody likes to be number four or number two. They want to be number one. And if number one is dead, well, then it's up for grabs, you know. I can, you know, just watch the Chronicles of Riddick. You'll see exactly what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter how powerful you are. It doesn't matter how wealthy or how omniscient you are or what air of, you know, supernatural power you may intimidate your followers with. You're a marked man or a marked woman. Now, somebody brought it up to me today. Well, what about the Queen of England? I mean, she's been around a long time. And I said, listen, the Queen of England has no power. She is a queen. Yes, she is wealthy, of course. Of course, but she is not directing the forces of the world. She doesn't command armies. She doesn't set national policy. She doesn't order people into war or order sanctions against one nation or another. She is a figurehead. Real power is threatened. If you are the president of the United States and you want to go golfing, you don't get a tee time. You get the golf course. And why is that? Well, it's not because you want to play through really quickly. It's because everyone on that golf course wants to see you dead. You understand? You have no privacy. And with the electric sociology that is occurring right now on our planet, there is no privacy for these people. And whether you think there's one all-powerful person on the planet or 12 or 33 or 120, I've heard all kinds of numbers, none of them can go to the grocery store. They can't go to a concert. They can't go to the beach. They can't send their kids to Disney World. Nothing. If they do, in fact, exist. Because that kind of power is envied. That kind of power has red laser points all over it from all kinds of people. Not just your enemies, but your friends. And that is the nature of our sociology right now. That entire network is changing as these tools are being placed into our hands, and really, really smart people are able to hack into these things and really make them fabulous or create applications for them to really make them powerful for you if you're a gamer or if you're a musician or if you're an artist or if you're a reporter or a mathematician or explorer of any kind. You now have the tools in your hands. You have better tools in your hands now to do things that have never been done before. And because you have tools that can do things that have never been done before, the things that you think of can become reality. Whether it's poetry or music or art or reporting, everything is instantly connected to everyone. And it has ramifications, both for good and for ill. For good, because we can find each other finally. We can talk things out. We can send love and beauty and communication and dispel fear and doubt among one another if we choose to. We can also take apart the structure of secrecy and darkness that is being put together around us. You know it. I know it. You see it every day. I mean, are you blind? Can you not see the militarization of the police force? Do you not see those cameras posted on poles and wires and signal lights and everything, buildings all around you as you travel around your town? Do you not see that? Of course it's all being collected. And what you do and what you say will have implications upon the future. I said it in 1972, right before I published my first article. I wrote, everything we do will eventually affect the universe. And later in life, I added, do it on purpose. Oh, you affect the universe whether you want to or not, whether you try to or not, you are doing it. Everything around you is being affected. Who you smile at, who you love, who you hate, who you strike, who you steal from, who you help, who you work for, and what you think about affects the entire universe eventually. I know eventually is a long time. It's almost as long as eternity. But you remember this, you know, you are in control. Yes, you are. No, there's no being out there forcing you to do anything. And much as you have been taught in your life to fear things, you should not be afraid of anything because you cannot die. There is no one that can take anything from you, whether you are jailed, whether you are beaten to death or shot in the head while you're walking down the sidewalk. Nothing can be taken from you. Nothing. You are an eternal being having a mortal experience. And now you are alive, mortal, in an electric sociology, and you can do whatever you want to do. You can be whatever you want to be. Now, does that mean you can have the job of president? There can be only one. Okay? There can be only one. And with these great positions, you realize that great amounts of the universe must resonate with your cause at one time in order to generate that manifestation. And if it doesn't happen, it's not going to happen for four more years. Get it? Other than that, if you wanted to be a president of a company, you wanted to be a teacher or an engineer or an artist or a musician or a parent or a great scout leader, you can do that. It is within your reach to do it, and it is within your capabilities to do it. It is often said God does not care about your capabilities. He only cares about your availability. So if you make yourself available to him and his purpose, he will take care of the capability. That's an extension, basically, of everything you do will eventually affect the universe. Do it on purpose. So as I sit here in the middle of my electric universe, my electric sociology, sending out my thoughts and my pontifications on the potential of all potentialities for you, maybe I am affecting the universe and maybe I'm not, whether you're listening live or whether you're working on your favorite project at home. You must realize all of this is in your control. There is no one out there judging you. No one. There's no one saying, you go to heaven, you go to hell. You go to heaven, you go to hell. It isn't there. Don't let anybody tell you it is there, because it's not true. It doesn't resonate with what God's message is. What is truth is that you judge yourself. You judge yourself by the very energy, if you want to call it vibrational level, if you want to call it spirit, that you allow the space to become, to gain strength. And let me explain that more carefully. It doesn't mean that you can be a genius overnight. It doesn't mean that you can be a doctor or a teacher or an engineer or an artist overnight. But it is your choice. You can choose to be that. And with the right amount of time and the right amount of work and the right amount of positioning and a small amount of resonation with the universe, you can be that. And I don't care if you're listening to this program and you're 18 or you're listening to this program and you're 60. The fact that your mortal life is punctuated by, you know, inevitable events like death is irrelevant to the argument. You can begin at any time. In fact, you must begin at any time. And if there are things that seem to be out of control in your life, it is because you have left them to chaos. In order to bring them under control, you must apply the right amount of energy, the right kind of anchoring thought process to that idea to bring them into control. And yes, there are all kinds of effects, and yes, the future is always in motion, as my wise Yoda would say. But that motion, the idea, the realization that there is motion in the future means that there's a driving force that's pushing that future around. Normally it's chaotic, but it can be very organized, and it can result in an ordered conclusion. And that ordered conclusion comes from the strongest force that's pushing that universe to happen. If that strongest force is you, believe me, there is no force in the universe that can stop it. It can't be done. It cannot be stopped, and it cannot be helped by God or a whole host of gods. Cannot happen. Everything you are, everything you do not have or have, is a result of your actions. Now, I'm not saying that you can't be born in captivity, or that you can't be born with some kind of handicap, or that you can't be born with some kind of sociological dissidence, black or you know, white in the wrong place or Asian in the wrong place. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying once you are aware, and that can happen at age 9 or 19 for some people I've never woken up that I know. But as soon as you are aware, you are capable of making changes in who you are and what you can be. You and you alone can break or make habits. You and you alone can develop hate or love or compassion for another person. It cannot be given to you. It comes from you. Now, a lot of people write me from time to time, and they even, you know, come up to me at conventions and say, how can I be happy? Happy is a different thing. Happiness is more of a gift. It's possible to give it to yourself, but I have not seen it actually work. It's more of a placebo. Now, placebos do work. I'm taking double the dose right now. Happiness is more of a gift from another spirit. And joy, true joy, lasting happiness, is a gift from the creator, from the designer. It's difficult to give to yourself. You can give it to another, which is exactly what he wants us to do. It is exactly. If we were to emulate him, we were to be like him so that we could recognize him when he comes, that is exactly what we're asked to do. Not pleasure. Keep in mind, I am talking about a very specific concept here. Not pleasure. Happiness. Joy. It is a different thing. It is a feeling that is very difficult to put into words. But you know when you don't have it. It goes back to those commandments even the apostles were wrestling with, you know. Coming to the master, not with a simple question, believe me, but it certainly had a simple answer, although it's been misinterpreted over the years. Master, what is the greatest commandment? We just want to know. I mean, what do we need to concentrate on here? All right, you've given us so much food and teaching and walking on water and healing and look, what's the greatest commandment? And you know the Savior didn't even hesitate. He said the first is to love thy God with all thy heart, might, mind, and spirit. So that's a tall order. The second is like unto it, to love thy neighbor as thyself. But remember, this was written in Greek. And the whole idea of the way to communicate in Greek is to make your point with syllogisms. That is to say, to speak in logical reverse. So if you put this in order, it becomes so simple, so beautiful, like E is equal to MC squared. You just sit in awe of how simple it is to relate energy, mass, and the speed of light to one another in that kind of relationship. I understand it finally. Well, here is E is equal to MC squared for the greatest commandment. Love yourself, and you will be so compelled to love your neighbor. And by doing so, you will be loving God. I can tell you from personal experience, reading, and let's just call it revelation, that you cannot love another without loving yourself first. You cannot hate yourself and love another. You cannot think that you are despised, ugly, sad, weakened, filthy rags, as it were, and love another. It doesn't happen. The love will be false. It will be sensed to be false. It will be rejected. It will dry in the sun and wither and blow away. But if you love yourself first, guess what you're going to know? Yourself. And you're going to be true to yourself. And then when you speak love to another, guess who is going to listen? Mm-hmm. That person, the universe, God, everyone, because you have given something that you have. When you tell someone that you love them, it will come out in your voice, of course, but it will come out in your eyes, it will come out in your energy, and you will feel it through your touch, and they will know. As you will. It really is love. And when you have that kind of love, when you're taught that kind of love, and you give that kind of love, then you understand love. And violence and war and conflict flee far away. You only wish well for everyone. So it is written, so it shall be. All right, Earth Explorers, Electric Sociology. What a great hour. I just liked where that whole thing went. Let's take a break. We'll come back after listening to, let's listen to Jody, Alana, and Morgan again. I like it. You guys like it. You can call me anytime, 888-429-5471. We'll be right back after this.
Through you. she'd side you to her kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
Two of X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 85 degrees and clear. It should be a good night to get out and see the Perseids, if you like wishing upon a falling star. Thank you, Jody, Alana, and Morgan, with Hallelujah. Leonard Cohen, amazing, amazing poet. Love his music. Rock on, Leonard. Did a great thing and continue to do it. By the way, he still tours, you know, 80-something years old. Great stuff. Great stuff. Never stop. Never stop. All right. Our phone lines are open, 888-429-5471. You can call from anywhere in North America free. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you want to reach this program tonight, you must call 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. Phone lines are open. Okay, that was a great hour, electric sociology, and how the sun's polarity shift might affect the sociology of our planet. I like the way things go in live radio. Just enjoy it. And thank you all for listening. Thank you so much also for the emails that I get. I I'm humbled and inspired to continue on after 8 years with BBS Radio. We, a lot of very fine hosts on the BBS Radio network now. By the way, if you're not familiar with BBS Radio, it is the network with the most live content on webcast radio of any network in the world. And it is going to continue to get better, mostly because of the skill and the deep love that Don and Doug Newsome have for you and for what they do. And we appreciate them being in Paradise, California. If you think you have it in you to be a talk radio personality, then I do too. So you should contact me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. And I will help you. I will sponsor you. And have had a few that have taken the challenge and have tried their best to make a go of it. Everyone should try it for a while. And who knows? You might really find what you're really, really good at. And we might really enjoy sitting back or driving around the country or listening to you on our cell phones while we're working on our favorite projects. All right, this hour. Oh, I also wanted to let you know that the upcoming Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference is coming. This begins October 10th and it goes through the 13th. And it is in Boulder, Colorado. And if you want to find it, all you have to do is go to x2-radio@x2-radio.com. Right there in the middle of the page, you'll see the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. Now, if you're anywhere within 500 miles of Boulder, Colorado, I think you need to set a goal to be there. Now, it's affordable, of course. You can stay at any one of the hotels that are listed on the website, or you can stay with friends. Believe me, we'll find a way for you to get in. The reason you need to be there is not only are the speakers going to be great, the presentations, the music at the last one in Holland was just phenomenal. I'm just unbelievable. The opening day music was this Mexican artist who came, and he actually blended his music with an electronic musician. It was so amazing to see this dancer, this feathered dancer, singer, amazing, you know, singing in ancient Mayan, and this modern electronic musician working together to make this presentation. Oh my gosh. Talk about the past meets the future right there on stage. And you don't see things like that unless you are there. So you need to come. Not only will you see that, but I would love to meet you. You're going to see our electric vehicle, our electric truck. We're going to have one for sure. We may have two. And then we have other friends who have electric vehicles that may show up. The folks from Atlas Shrugged are going to come, and it's rumored that the trailer for Atlas Shrugged 3 is going to debut at this. So it's really going to be a great place to be. This is where the universe is going to shift. So if you're within 500 miles of Boulder, Colorado, please register now at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. You could just Google it, or you can go to X Squared Radio. I prefer you to go there, and that way we can track you in, and we know who you are, and we can help you. Also, don't forget, the challenge is still open. We are trying to get a copy of Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty. This is the Amazon best-selling book, number one in two different categories, into the hands of 40 governors. There are 40 states that have passed sovereignty acts. We'll talk a little bit about that in the third hour. And these governors need to have this book because it, like James Madison of old, gives them a structure by which these 40 governors can, in a single weekend, without firing a shot, take apart the agency government. They can take the giant apart. They can stop government from ruling over us and make us represented in our government again. they can fix our constitutional form of government with this simple book. So what I'm asking you to do is to go to Amazon or go to alienatednation.com and order the book. Order two copies, one for yourself. You'll get the audio version for free if you do that. And the second one, I want you to give to the governor. If you don't have a way, then get it to one of his staffers. Go to one of his offices and give them the book. Okay? Go to the governor's office somewhere in the state. They have satellite offices that have to do with his reelection. If you can't do that, go to your senator that's running for reelection, if you have one, or your congressman. Get to their office and say, I need to get this book in the hands of the governor. Now, obviously, they'll have it in their hands and they can hand carry it. If you mail it, it may never get there because it goes through all kinds of screeners and they're afraid of things that come in. Very fearful people, you know, very, very fearful people. But you need to get this book into his hands. And I can send it. Yes, of course, I can find a way to do it. But it's so much easier if I delegate this responsibility to those people who are in those states who know how to do this. Please, please get this book into the hands of your governor. Alienated Nation, the New Path for Liberty. All right. This hour kicks off with this story of Super Honey. Yes, Super Honey. A new honey has been produced that has had amazing results treating wounds and infections. The bioengineered product is called Surja Honey, and it was tested on babies, new mothers, cancer patients, and the elderly for over a year in New Hampshire hospitals. Now, wounds and ulcers, including those infected with the superbug MRSA, healed within days. While the number of women who suffered infections after giving birth by cesarean section fell in half, 50% reduction. It has also healed the wounds of soldiers returning from Afghanistan and been used to treat acne and to protect the skin of cancer patients fitted with a catheter for chemotherapy. Dr. Matthew Dryden, consultant microbiologist at the Hampshire Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust, said it will revolutionize wound care around the world. Honey has been used throughout the ages for its healing powers, either as a topical ointment or as a food, although doctors favor penicillin and antibiotics. Bacteria can survive that. Now, usually it kills 99.999% of the bacteria. That's true. But you got to remember, bacteria have sometimes billions of cells in their colony. And even 99.999% times a billion, guess what? You get survivors. And the survivors will multiply. And eventually you'll have a colony that is immune to the antibiotic. But Super Honey, this Surja Honey, is not necessarily an antibiotic in that sense. Surja Honey, which is stored in 10-gram what's called sachets, can kill bacteria, parasites, and fungal infections while also encouraging the wounds to heal. In other words, the body's natural ability to grow and to heal. Dr. Dryden said, I have conducted numerous laboratory tests and compared it with honeys from around the world. I found Surja Honey better for treating every type of bug. So for the past year, I have been using it on patients and the results have been amazing. There are plenty of products that can kill bacteria, but they often don't help heal the tissue. Honey is a fantastic natural medicine. The important extra is that it kills the bugs, but doesn't damage the tissue. Surja Honey is being developed by Ian Staples, a businessman who once owned the Halfords Motor Accessories chain. He bought an organic farm in southern Chile, set up beehives, and then funded scientific researchers in Ireland to identify the unique healing elements. The honey has been licensed by the Medicines and Healthcare Products regulatory authority in the UK, but is not yet commercially available. Good luck against the FDA. You're not only a drug, you're a food. I'm going to attack you from all sides. By the way, Alex, don't fret. I am going to answer your question. It has to do with what we're going to cover in the next hour. So I promise you I will answer the question. If you have questions you want to send me, you don't want to come on the air, that's fine. You can go to Skype, find me, Brooks Agnew, easy enough. My handle is X2-Radio, and just send me a Skype message, and I'll get it. People in Australia and Wales and all over the country that send me messages while we're on the air, and I do my best to answer them. And if you want me to, I will call your name out. And if you don't want me to, I won't. That's fine. Now, I want to get back to what's going on in healthcare in this hour. And I think that it may resonate with some of you. Some of you may be confused by it, but here we go. This kind of goes back to the idea that, mankind is evolved or mankind is created. Hold on 1 second. Grapefruit juice. And how is that? Ah, wow. You have no idea how refreshing that is when you're talking. The reason that it inevitably reaches back here, and I want to solve this problem in the beginning of this hour, there was a book, a textbook developed by a professor. And the name is inconsequential, but it was a national bestseller, which is really odd for a textbook. Because textbooks are normally written by the professor who is teaching the class, and so they're required in his class. And so that book is used by, his students, so it doesn't typically turn out to be a bestseller. Normally, textbooks can run $100 or to $300 because they just cost that much to publish, all the color pictures and glossy pages and hard covers and blah, blah, blah. You get the picture. Yes, of course, Random House or, one of the great textbook publishers may publish it, but somebody has to pay for it. And it's usually either the school or the writer himself. It's very difficult to self-publish a textbook with that kind of quality. That being said, the reason that this book was a national bestseller is because it was so well written. And it was called Biological Predestination. Now, don't run out and buy a copy. It's a big, thick book on biochemistry. And if you're not a chemist and you're not a biologist, you're not going to get off on this book at all. It's not a novel, but it will help you pass all the pre-med courses. Still, very well-written book, very well laid out, easy to understand. And the professor that wrote this book was somewhat of an icon in this field. And if you were privileged enough to take a class from this genius of a man, this wonderful presenter, this great organizer of scientific thought, you were blessed. You were truly blessed. Your career definitely changed. During one of his lectures, one of his students, we don't know if it was an upperclassman or a freshman, but asked a very fresh question. And that was so fundamental, so amazing in its elegance and its simplicity, that it actually took this wonderful thinker, this magnificent organizer, some weeks to answer it in his mind. And the answer actually changed his life. The question was, as they were talking about protein replication. How do I explain this? Okay, let's say you have a message that is written on a long roll of paper, like a roll of drywall paper. You get 300 feet of paper rolled up into a simple 2-inch wide roll of paper. and you have a formula that is written on this paper, and then it is rolled up. And by the way, the formula is written on the top and the bottom of the seam on this paper, duplicated. And then you roll the 300-foot piece of paper up, and you take it to someone and say, I want to duplicate this onto another roll of paper. And so you unroll the paper, and you carefully tear the paper apart at the seam. So you end up with 2 1-inch wide slices of paper, okay? But same formula on each one. And then somehow you're able to add something, add a blank piece of paper, and it copies the formula over. Now, two things happen. First of all, you unroll this long paper, which has thousands and thousands of symbols on it of this formula that you've written out. Someone sits down and very quickly copies those formula down from the top seam to the fresh bottom seam. And sometimes, not very often, but sometimes they make a mistake. And then you roll the paper back up and put it into the machine and realize the machine is doing something slightly different than it did before because of the copying error, okay? Because of the copying error in copying it from the top and the bottom seam. This is protein replication. Proteins roll themselves up into these macromolecules. Some of them are 500,000 in molecular weight. Lots and lots of elements tied together to make these proteins. The proteins unroll themselves, replicate through an enzymatic process, and then roll themselves back up and go back to work. That's how cells are replaced. That's how we grow from a one-cell or two-cell zygote, a sperm and an egg, to a full-grown human being. And how, when we damage something, either by rubbing our skin against something or by some kind of cut or something, we have to remake cells to go in there. That's how it's done, is this protein replication. Sometimes there are mutations. They are rare. Some of them are non-functional and never replicate again, and some are functional, and you end up with some kind of different tissue, a tumor or some abnormality. And that's basically what the whole textbook is about, is this biological process of making and replicating proteins from genes to proteins, from proteins to proteins. How is it done? And then this amazingly elegant and simple question came out. And the question was, okay, all well and good, I'm not going to debate with you about how proteins are replicated, but I do have a question. And the question is, where did the first protein come from? Where did the first DNA molecule come from? And rather than just shoot from the hip, this was a question that so profoundly caught this wonderful professor, this great author, this great explainer of complex organic chemistry, off guard, caught him without an answer. And he basically said, listen, I'll get back to you. And it wasn't just, I'll get back to you, please don't bother me again. It was, I'll get back to you, and I'm really going to think about this. And he did. And his conclusion changed his life. The conclusion was that DNA was an engineered molecule. It could not have evolved. It was built. The way the DNA is put together, the function of the molecule itself, the core to genetic information that builds genes, that build chromosomes, that allow proteins to replicate, that makes the proteins for the body, anybody, is an engineered molecule. It had to be built by someone. Which means that either somebody in this universe knows how to make DNA, or somebody outside the universe does and brought it here or built it here using the materials that are in this universe. That's the only way it could have happened. God. Intervention, some call it. Still, in the beginning, that's the beginning before the beginning. I mean, because there was at one time no beginning, right? There was at one time no thing. There was only the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep and divided the waters from the waters. And you know the story. But the Spirit of God came from somewhere, some place, into the deep and changed the deep in that process. Oh, of course, all the details are not there in the Bible, but in order for it to occur, DNA had to be built. And whether it was built from another dimension to this one, or whether it was done through some divine process or not, is irrelevant to the argument. The argument is that DNA is an engineered molecule. Now, that being said, it is the basis of all life. Eve, the mother of all living, it is the basis for all life. DNA is found in every living thing on this planet, and there are a plethora of living things on this planet. Take your mind 900 million miles out into space and turn around and look back at Earth. And when you do, you'll see this little blue star. Oh, the name of the book is Biological Predestination. You can buy it on Amazon. It's still out there. It has a different edition now that explains that DNA is an engineered molecule. But you'll also find the author, which I don't really want to get into the author or not, but he is worshipped in the world of organic chemistry. Biological Predestination. The idea is that this DNA is in everything. It's in every bacteria. It's in multicelled animals, plants, every living thing on this planet. And there are species that no longer exist here, ones we never knew about, let alone the birds, the dinosaurs, the fish. Forget about that. Even the one-celled animals that lived 1, 2, 5 generations couldn't make it and died. Hundreds of millions of species gone. We are losing species every day on this planet. Every day. And new species are being formed. Why? Because this planet is full of life. The interaction between the dirt of Earth, the soul of Earth, and the soul of man is irrefutable. To drive a man into the wilderness and give him rain and a few seeds, he can survive because he can place the seeds in the earth with the water, and the earth will bring forth bounty, and he can live on that bounty. And ultimately, that's what every one of us do. Whether you're buying at Whole Foods or whether you're going out in your home garden, it is the process of life. That DNA is formed by CO2, water, and sunshine, and the minerals in the earth. It grows, gives forth fruit. We eat that DNA. It makes more DNA in our bodies, and we are what we eat. Doesn't make a lot of sense, though, because I eat the same things that my sons eat, and yet I'm old, and they're not. That's not fair. What's wrong with this? We're both eating the same food. We're both making the same DNA. That's another story. We're talking about this story. The bottom line is, well, not the bottom line. The main theme of this hour is that we're discovering the simple beauty of life and how it works. The biological transducer that makes up our human body, in which our spirit is encased, through which we interpret the universe, is truly an amazing machine. I mean, the physiology of it alone can take a lifetime to understand. We often hear, you know, well, your hormones are out of balance, and that's why you're feeling the way you're feeling. That's utter nonsense, because there's no such thing as balanced hormones. If there's no such thing as balanced hormones, how can there be imbalanced hormones? What we do see is that hormones, which are secreted by different organs in the body, do regulate processes. For women and for men, it is different because of our sex, because of how we're built and the purpose for which the biological transducer exists. But the hormones do have their effect. We are born with as men with a certain amount of testosterone that bleeds off after age, I don't know, 18 or 20, it begins to bleed off. Our ability to produce it goes down, 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 and our body shape begins to change. Our stamina begins to change. We grow old and die. For women, it's leans a little bit more to the estrogen side, but you get the idea. The point is that the systems are complex and that sometimes they don't work very well. Things that we should make, we don't make, like insulin. Insulin allows the body to process sugar. If we don't have insulin in our system, then the 5-carbon sugar that we partake can actually drive our body into shock. If we make too much insulin, then we can actually reduce our blood sugar to the point where we can't stay conscious. We pass out, go into a coma, and die. And the same thing happens with too much sugar, not enough insulin. Now, the pancreas knows how to make insulin unless you're born with a pancreas that doesn't, or you develop a pancreas that does not. And so there's a story out where an individual was not making any insulin and was almost repeatedly going into coma, into shock, because they had sugar in their system they couldn't get rid of. And for some reason, you know, the pump didn't work and injections didn't work. The sugar was just so difficult to control, just very, very difficult to control in this body. And so somehow this individual became part of some kind of a trial. And he received what was called long-term insulin. And once that insulin was injected into his body, he didn't have to take daily injections anymore. Everything evened out, and he was able to live a normal life. Well, one day, or after this change occurred in his life, he looked at the bottle itself, at the vials, and what it said on the bottle was rDNA. And that's what really piqued his curiosity, because he said to himself, wait a minute, this is not long-term insulin. It looks to me like recombinant DNA. And I'm injecting it into my body, and somehow it's making this change. And I made the comment that this could be what's called enzymatically transported drugs. We do that. We have done it for a while, actually more than a decade, in certain kinds of experimental chemotherapy. And I've explained it before on this program before, but let me just explain the chemistry of it just for a second. One of the things that we know is that cancerous tissues are more dense than healthy tissues. That is to say, the matter that makes up a cancer tumor or tumors is thicker. It's almost like bone, except that it is flexible. And if you know, when you go get an X-ray, when the X-rays hit your body, they go through your body and hit the film. If they're blocked by something in your body, then the film turns dark. White. If they go through your body, then it turns dark. And if you're skilled in radiology, you can interpret these based on the dose and the angle at which the X-rays are irradiated at you, and the image on the film. And it can actually be pretty high resolution if you know what you're looking for. Well, that's why cancer tissues show up a little more white, a little more milky, not quite like bone, but that's because they're more dense. We talk about incidents of collision. It's sort of like shooting a golf ball at a tennis net or shooting a golf ball at a fish net. Well, at a tennis net, the holes are about 1 inch big, but a fish net, the holes are pretty small. So the odds of the golf ball going through a tennis net are pretty good, but going through a fish net is probably going to get caught. That's exactly what we're talking about, incidents of collision. When we irradiate these particles, we do our best to try to direct them, but in drugs we cannot. We know that they're going to emit, or they're going to decay and put off this photon. But when it hits the tissue, it kills it. So the idea is that we put radiation into the body at a certain spot, or we irradiate the body in a certain spot. And yes, it goes through the body and has harm on the body, but for healthy tissue, some harm. For cancerous tissue, a lot of harm. And so over time, over a month or two, the idea is that all of the cancerous cells are killed, but only a portion of the healthy cells are killed, and you'll heal. Now, yes, radiation can in and of itself also cause cancer, but that's the gist of it. And so what we do is we will take an elixir, and we will make it up sometimes with the enzymes. Enzymes, as I have explained in the past, are these macromolecules that have very, very, very specific receptors on the outside of it that act like a key. And the key is specifically coded to a certain lock in the human body. So the enzyme is going to float around the human body, and it won't go into any lock that it's not supposed to, and then it finds the lock that it's made it up to, and boom, it hooks up. That's how enzymes work. And so what we will do is we will attach a bismuth atom. A bismuth has a huge nucleus. And the rest of it is basically carbon, which is really open, not very dense material. The bismuth is like a big lead ball in this thing. And we will take it over and expose it to a californium source. Californium, as you know, puts off lots and lots of fairly high energy neutrons, and the neutrons will stick to the bismuth, okay? These high energy neutrons will hit the nucleus of bismuth and they will stick there temporarily. They'll stay there for an hour, maybe two, and then they're going to come off. And when they come off, it's called an alpha decay, and this alpha decay is like a wrecking ball. And when it comes off for a certain distance, it is going to kill anything dense that it runs into. So we irradiate this for a few minutes, let the bismuth soak up all the proteins that it or neutrons that it's going to, and then we'll very quickly transport this to the hospital. We will inject it into the patient or let it go intravenously into the patient, try to direct it. If it's a lymphatic system where we're going to, you know, a couple hundred lymph nodes, then it's system-wide. If it's somewhere, you know, near a certain organ, then we'll inject it near the certain organ just to make it easy. But the enzymes take that drug right to where it's supposed to go, enzymatically transported. Okay? And then it arrives, it sits there all hooked up and ready to go, and during the next hour or so, that bismuth atom decays. Those high-energy neutrons come off, and the wrecking ball process occurs. But it's local, okay? You're not killing brain tissue when you should be attacking something on the liver or something in the pancreas. And so that's how it works. It's called enzymatic transportation. So my guess was that what they had done is they had taken recombinant DNA and they had attached it to an enzyme which transported this DNA to the patient's pancreas. And when it reached the receptor sites of the pancreas, the DNA made itself available to the cells in the pancreas, and the cells learned how to make DNA again. Learned how to make insulin again. And so this quote-unquote long-term insulin was actually recombinant DNA that was enzymatically transported to the site in the pancreas, and that DNA was made available to the cell, the wall tissue inside the pancreas where insulin is manufactured, and it taught the pancreas how to make insulin again. Is this what happened? I have really no facts to back this up. But if I was going to design a recombinant DNA process, I would take some kind of viral macrophage. A macrophage is like an eagle lander that lands on the moon, except it has very, very specific purposes, because inside this capsule is not astronauts, it's DNA. it's DNA material is inside this capsule. And the capsule is designed with certain docking systems so that it will dock exactly to a cell that you're looking for. And namely an insulin manufacturing cell. And it docks up with it, and as soon as it docks, the airlock opens and the DNA exits the macrophage and goes into that cell, right into the cell. And when the DNA goes into that cell, it is available for when that cell divides. It could divide tomorrow, it could divide next week, but when that cell divides, guess what? It has new DNA to work with. And that teaches that cell how to do what it was supposed to do. It, we're using the process of virus infection. That's how you get the flu. You get a flu virus, you're not getting a bacterial infection. You're receiving a little eaglelander, and inside that eaglelander is a flu virus. Now, the front part of the virus, they almost all look the same. I mean identical, going back thousands of years. But the tail end of it undergoes a lot of mutations, simply because flu doesn't normally kill the host. And the flu is manufactured trillions upon trillions of times. And so the secondary part of the flu virus goes through a lot of mutations, and hence we get H1N1, H7N9, all these different kinds of iterations of it. Now, the problem is if we make a vaccine which makes you immune to a specific flu, it can make you immune to other things as well. You might not get a cold for years if you get a flu shot. Unfortunately for the drug industry, they have been concentrating on the tail end of the flu. Oh, we're going to give it for swine flu or bird flu or fish flu or whatever kind of flu. But the main part, the A part, the front end of the flu virus, they don't build a vaccine for that. If they made a vaccine for the front end of the flu, it wouldn't matter what flu you got. You'd be immune to it. Now, for most of us, the vast majority of us, our immune systems work just fine. This foreign material comes in, the flu virus injects its DNA into a cell, it begins to generate its histamine reaction or whatever kind of achy, painy reaction it's going to do. Our body responds by taking out those cells as quickly as possible, and we actually build an antivirus against that virus, and we then become immune to it. Once you've had the flu, you don't often re-catch the flu. You're now immune to it because you have antibodies. So as soon as that virus shows up, guess what? And the antivirus is there, or the ability for your body to recognize it is there. It ties it up, and out of the body it goes without giving you any of the symptoms. We don't have a cure for any virus, nothing. We can cure no virus, okay? Not even the cold. We can't cure it. But we can treat the symptoms while your body fights it off. If your body doesn't fight it off, then you're going to die. And that's just what happens. Babies and old people and people that have weakened immune systems often succumb to flu because it generates a tremendous histamine reaction. Histamine reaction means that your mucous membranes go crazy, your nose and your lungs fill up with fluid. Bacteria grows in the fluid that's anaerobic, that doesn't like oxygen, because now you have this deep amount of fluid in your lungs. That bacteria blooms. The waste product from that bacteria is very toxic, and it poisons you and kills you. It's called pneumonia. So we're now using the macrophage process, these little eaglelanders. We're putting our own DNA inside of them, our own ideas inside of them, and we're using them to reinfect the body with what we want to infect the body with. And we're using enzymes to attach to the macrophages to deliver them to where they go. And we're having remarkable effects. One of the latest articles to come out where they have proven this is the advent of green rabbits. Now, I don't mean environmentally friendly rabbits. I mean green rabbits. And it doesn't mean that they're born green. It means that when they're born, they are exposed to a black light, very short wavelength light. And very long wavelength light, like infrared. And what happens is the ones that have received the change through birth, because what they'll do is they'll give it to the mother, and then the mother will have pups. And the pups, approximately 20% of the pups will have received this new genetic change. When you expose the young with black light, the young that have received it will show up green, like they fluoresce, like they're fluorescent. And it's not to create rabbits that glow in the dark. That's not the point of it. The point of it is that it was a light test to show which rabbits had received the change and which had not. It was a photo marker to tell which ones had received the gene and which ones had not. It's sort of the front end of very targeted recombinant DNA therapy. It can be a blessing, and it can also be quite terrible. Let me explain both of those as soon as I take a sip of this. Hold on. It can be quite terrible because, you know, nature likes to do its ravaging things, and it often shows up as mutations or things that don't allow the body to live very long. Occasionally, though, occasionally, and we call this process, Darwinian process, this survival of the fittest, this adaptation process. No. It's not evolution, okay? It's natural selection. It's a numbers game. Eventually, some mutation is going to give that being a survivability advantage. Like a white moth on beech trees or a black moth on oak trees, it gives it a survivability advantage. If there's no survivability advantage, then it's not going to change anything. Obviously, a biological disadvantage is going to result in death or predation. Something is going to see it and eat it because it's not able to move out of the way. And several things are being used to generate or to hasten this kind of natural selection. Of course, you can use recombinant DNA. We're trying it now. Are we playing God? It's debatable, but it's there, and they're going to do it, and you can't stop them. The point is that some of these advanced natural selection changes can be beneficial. For instance, teaching the pancreas to make insulin again. But suppose you wanted to take a very specific genetic code, and you wanted to build a toxin that only worked on that genetic code. Well, you see where that could go. And maybe it has gone there a couple times, or attempts have been made. And there are other methods. Jeff writes me and says, what about blood electrification? Absolutely. It works. I've tried it. It has made some profound changes. Electrification can be done a couple different ways. No, don't go grab the wires out of your wall socket. It is an AC. That doesn't work. It's got to be DC, and the magnetic field has to be very specific. The pulse frequency has to be very specific, but it does work. Believe me, 5 million volts applied in the right way at the right time can re-energize the cells of the body, and if those cells should happen to divide in the next 24 hours, then they're going to divide at the higher energy level because they've been recharged electrically. And cells that are particularly susceptible to this are bone cells, also the gray matter of the brain, and also optical cells. So you can take eyes, for instance, that normally at age 40 or 45 or 50 or 55 or 60, you should have some pretty thick glasses on. You may not have to do that because it keeps optical tissue pretty fresh. I'm 58 years old, and I'm not wearing glasses to read my computer screen right now. Gray matter, it is highly clinically backed up, huge amount of data, deep brain stimulation that is being done with magnetic coils right now, electromagnetic coils. These coils, they basically drill a hole in your head, And Alex brings up a good point. That's good. He says that's our potential. Why not practice playing God now? It doesn't mean we are God. Very good point, Alex. Anyway, of course, this is very low amperage. I'm talking about 5 million volts, but the amperage is low amperage. Otherwise, you begin to get some rather interesting arcing going on, and you don't want to see that happen. Although when it's applied to the center, directly to the center of the head between the eyes, you can visualize amazing amounts of light, even though it's not coming through your eyes. It's going up the optic nerves to the brain. The point is that the cells are reactivated. The synapses are re-energized. Memories, the ability to not only remember things, but to identify things, associate things, build new neural pathways or energize neural pathways so that cross-disciplinary thought is very possible. Have I seen it work? Absolutely. I've seen Parkinson's tremors go away. I've seen cognizance be prolonged, awareness, dementia, all kinds of things. Now, is the FDA going to sanction this? No, it ain't going to happen. If you want to know more about this, you need to go to zeropointresearch.com. Zeropointresearch.com. Check it out for yourself. If you don't believe me, go get a treatment. Go to a clinic. Buy a unit for yourself. Keep one in your house. I have one. A Hyundai slammed into my leg a year ago this last May and broke it. My surgeon said, well, it isn't a compound fracture. The bones are still aligned, but it's broken. So you're probably going to have to wear a cast for 6 months. I said, I'll tell you what, put a boot on me, and I'll go home, and I'll come back in a couple of weeks, and we'll look at it again. So that's what he did. I went home. I put it on the live stream generator, threw 500,000 volts at it every day, and went back in 2 weeks, and the bone was knitting. So I didn't have to have a cast. And 6 weeks later, I was able to walk on it. Now, it's doing much better. It's only been a year, and it's basically I can do anything I want to do. Except for the longest part to heal was where the bumper of the car bent the crash bar on my motorcycle over, and it pinched my leg between the crash bar and the block of the motorcycle. Although I don't remember it being uncomfortable, I'm sure that it was, because looking at the wounds, it's something that you would do to yourself with a maul, not what you would want to see. Almost healed now, but the electricity itself in that specific frequency, and I'm not going to divulge the frequency, but it's very low, and this magnetic field, absolutely positively critical to the effectiveness of the treatment. Do not use AC electricity. It is not good for you, and it will not work. It has to be DC, direct current. It has to be pulsed at an exact frequency, or it's not going to work. And that electricity will re-energize the cells, and your body will do exactly what it's designed to do. Lots going on there. Anyway, I want to wrap up this hour by saying that all of these effects are being experimented with in different ways, and hopefully they're being experimented with in a good way. This recombinant DNA is Pandora's box, I am afraid. And if, one of the things that universities do a lot, my brother was chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins for a long time, and because he's in Baltimore, spent a lot of time writing grants and going to Washington back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Why? To raise money. Because it takes money to buy the equipment, to pay the grad students, to pay the professors, to pay the salaries. The school needs the money. Guess who gives out those grants? Ah, you got it right. First time. That's exactly right. The folks down at Wars R Us. That's who gives out most of the grants. How can this be used as a weapon? We need to know this, because if it can be used as a weapon, that means our enemies are going to use it. And it means that we have to be able to protect ourselves against it. So first we build the weapon, and then we build the anti-weapon, and we promise that we'll behave ourselves with it. Have they ever? I don't really want to answer that question, but I would say no, they really haven't. Every time they get the big red button, dang it, they press it. They press the button every single time. I'm so, you know, frustrated with them. I just don't know what to do there. But anyway, let's go ahead. I got about 2 minutes. I can wait a little bit. Let's just wait just a little bit longer here, especially if I can keep this iPad from going dead. Let me see if I can plug it in here. Maybe I can give it a little juice and it won't go dead. Hold on one moment. Let's see if that works. Well, it says not charging, but we'll see what happens. All right. The idea that we are biological transducers, we're spiritual beings having a mortal experience, and the biological transducer, which is the human body, works very well for some and not so well for others. Governments are trying to seize control of the planet by capitalizing on health insurance. I almost said health care, and that would have been wrong, because it has nothing to do with health care. It has everything to do with health insurance. What they want is the money and the control, because if they can control the money, then they can control who lives and who dies. It's important to them for some reason. I have no idea. 85% of us really don't have much to worry about because we're healthy. 15% of us have some kind of chronic illness that needs to be treated our entire lives to live some method of normalcy. And that number grows every year. Why? Well, think about it, people. You have a genetic weakness. You are able to live a quasi-normal life, to get married, have kids. Your kids have that weakness, and it proliferates. So in the past, those with asthma couldn't run across the frozen tundra with the battle axe in hand, and so they perished. Now we treat asthma, and those people can live a normal life, and so asthma is passed on to the next person. By the way, the website again is zeropointresearch.com, zeropointresearch.com. Go there. You can get a hold of John Riley. He's a good friend of mine. If this is your journey, you can get a live stream generator to use. If you like it, you'll buy it. If you don't like it or you can't afford it, then go to someone who has one and get treated. Because there are people that, you know, make little clinical house call businesses out of this, and they do quite well. And there are hundreds of thousands of people out there being treated with these things, and it's wonderful. They're all over the planet. I've used them from 500,000 volts all the way up to 6,000,000 volts. In fact, we put two of them together one time and did pretty close to 15,000,000 volts. Awesome stuff. Really great. We'll change your biology, and you'll see changes almost immediately. I've even had people with shingles. If you've ever had shingles, I haven't, but if you've ever had chicken pox, eventually in your life, sometime in your 70s or 80s, you're going to end up with shingles. And this is great for stopping that viral reaction. So just get a hold of them and make it happen for yourself. Let's go ahead and take a quick break. If the iPad will stay going for another 5 minutes, we'll take a break, and we'll be right back after this. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what
dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 84 degrees, clear skies. If you want to go outside in about an hour and a half, you should be able to see some Perseid fireballs. It could be interesting if you like wishing upon such things. This is the peak tonight and tomorrow night, and it will continue for about another week and a half. And also, don't forget, in October, we have the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference, October 10th through the 13th. This is in Boulder, Colorado. If you want to know more about it, go to x2-radio.com. Go down to about the center of the page, and you will see the link for the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. Why do you need to be there? Because this is where the universe is going to be greatly affected. Not only will there be our electric truck there, it is rumored that the trailer for Atlas Shrugged 3, the movie about the book by Ayn Rand called Atlas Shrugged, is going to debut. But you will also be exposed to many of the world's greatest leading-edge new energy devices. Some of these are efficiency devices. Some of them capture energy from various resonations of Earth and space and make it usable for you in small amounts. And some of them are just nothing but flat breakthroughs, absolute phenomenal breakthroughs. Why are they not on your shelf at home? Well, that is a point that will be vehemently talked about at this conference. We will be exhorting those who are investors, those who have the financial capability to get these prototypes into production. We will also be reaching out to various government agencies to try to get some attention for this absolutely disruptive and breakthrough technology. Famous names, Keisha, Searle, you know, we're talking about the people that have the ideas that are going to change the planet. Their stuff is going to be there. I was there last year in Holland. It was phenomenal. The people that run it have the highest integrity. They have their hearts in it. They have their love in it. And they want to see energy be available to the world. I don't think there's a billionaire among us or a would-be billionaire among us. We don't really care about that. What we want to see is us live within harmony of our planet, within the resources of our planet, without polluting it. It doesn't mean you have to go back to rubbing two sticks together to make fire. The technology is there. It's in the palm of your hand. You want to see it. So if you live within 500 miles of Boulder, Colorado, you get yourself there by car. If you're beyond that, you can fly there. Boulder, Colorado, October 10th. Check it out at X Squared Radio, x2-radio.com. Get registered now. It's affordable. We'll see you there. I also want to put out the call one more time. Please, please, the time is now. We have to get this book into the hands of these 40 governors. Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty. It is the Amazon number one best-selling book. You need to, you can write me at, or you can go to alienatednation.com and you can order it. You'll get the autographed copy and the audio version for free. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. If you want to go to Amazon, that's great. No problem. Go to Amazon and buy Alienated Nation. It's wonderful. It's affordable. I think it's about 13 bucks. You'll enjoy it. It's an easy read. It's got great stuff in there. The main thing that it has in there is it has a chapter that is designed for these governors. Once they get the information in their hands, they can, like James Madison of old, have this constitutional convention. They can repeal the three amendments that need to be gotten rid of and pass the six amendments that are in the book. If it's not those six, then they can make up others. But this, a lot of thought has gone into this. A lot of design has gone into this. You know, and I know how this agency government is now rules our country. Now, it's taken them 80 years. It's taken them 80 years to take over our country. But they did it. They did it. They own it. They own you. They own me. They own the streets, the buildings, the electricity, the healthcare system. They own it all. You can take it back. The people can take back their government. Congress can once again run the government. They don't. They don't. All right, this is an article by Thomas DeLorenzo. It's an important article. I picked it for this reason. It's not meant to pick on any one person, I promise. Let's just think of it as an ideological piece. And is designed, this hour is designed to arouse your faculties and call you to action. So here we go. Now, none of the names have been changed in this, okay? It only took the Obama administration a couple of weeks to prove that the national leadership of the Democratic Party is guided by totalitarian-minded socialists who seek to create an omnipotent government. Can I see a show of hands of everyone who agrees with that? That's what I thought. Okay. The U.S. government is now controlled by people who have been dreaming of living out their utopian socialist fantasies ever since the fantasies were brought to their attention in college decades ago by their Mao, Castro, Che, Guevara, poster-hanging, capitalism-hating, communistic professors. I had them. If you went to college, you had them. And I doubt that there's a university out there that isn't packed full of them. Exactly correct. Now, if you'll remember, in 1933, the agency government was established. It was established in one fell swoop by Soviet agents who had invaded our government. You don't believe me? You want to read the book. American Betrayal by Diana West. She was on this program. Go back to June. Listen to the interview. Listen to the interview. Last week we had a piece on an article. She's a columnist and she wrote a book called American Betrayal. Absolutely factual, people. In 1933, FDR put the agency government in place. It has grown every year since then. And now, here we are, 80 years later, 2013, and the agency government is now complete. It controls everything that is bought. It controls every bit of money that comes into the government. They control the printing of the money. They control the value of the money. They control your property. They control the air that you breathe. They control your healthcare system. They control the food that you eat. They control the job where you work. And now more than half of our country works for them. Half the United States of America works for them. The administration's main agenda is an explosion of federal spending and debt so large and so outrageous that America will soon exceed Sweden in the proportion of the economy that is controlled by governments, if it hasn't already. And that's just for starters. They also went to sharply increase taxes on the most productive and the hardest working people in society. increasing the capital gains tax to deter private investment, expand the welfare state, spent trillions on pure pork barrel spending and a massive vote buying spree. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake about it. Food stamp cards and Obama phones are vote buying. And they set all corporate compensation levels by governmental fiat. Tax away the wealth of unpopular business people, only starting with those AIG executives. I guess they started in alphabetical order. Regulate and control all risk-taking by private entrepreneurs. And now they're going after the money finders themselves. Yeah, because entrepreneurs are terrible at raising money. So who do they find? They go to money finders, and the money finders go to the investors, and the investors bring the money, and the money finders get paid. And guess what? The SEC has now gone after the money finders. Oh, you got a check from this company for helping them find an investment? That's illegal. You're going to jail. Oh, and by the way, the company that got all the money, you got to give it back. Oh, yeah, that's really helping American business. They enforce a civilian draft to create a modern-day American version of the Hitler Youth. It's creepy. The Stalinist-sounding book entitled The Plan to Nationalize Entire Industries. You know what that is? Nationalization. Do you know what fascism is? What? No, fascism. It is a process by which government nationalizes industries. The corporations themselves become government. General Motors, Government Motors. Okay, yeah, now you get it. Anyway, starting with the capital markets, they understand that there can be no capitalization without private capital markets, and double, triple, and quadruple the number of regulators who already regulate all aspects of human life in America. And guess what? Oh, yeah, they're all over that. All over that. They regulate the way money goes into business. We're now sitting at a 35% corporate tax rate. It's the highest in the world. Well, guess what? Yeah, the corporations that are actually making money, they don't want to pay 35% of it in federal tax, so they leave. They take their corporate structure to other countries, to Ireland, to Singapore, to Dubai. They take their corporate structures there because those countries charge a lot less in taxes. And so guess what? The U.S. government gets nothing. They get nothing because the corporate profits are made in another country. And they take their jobs with them. In order to bring those jobs back to America, in order to allow corporations to stay in America, they must lower or eliminate the corporate income tax. They don't pay it anyway. You pay it. At the recent G20 meeting, Obama even signed off on the creation of an international regulatory authority that would set compensation policies in American corporations. And that means that you can only make so much money. On top of this, there is a never-ending drumbeat of anti-capitalist propaganda coming from the administration and its worshipful mouthpieces in the mainstream media. If you're corporate, you are the enemy. If you are a concealed carry holder, you are the enemy of America. Do you understand where we're going with this? What can be done? How can this rush toward totalitarian socialism, fascism, be stopped? Will the Republicans or Tea Party find another old angry geezer to appeal to the angry white male vote? I mean, have we had enough John McCain's? Have we? Really? I mean, we ran him against Obama and it was a joke. Now, Romney was a little bit different. He was not so animated of a character, maybe just a tad clumsy, but he was honest. And he was successful, and I think he would have surrounded himself with smart people with integrity, and he would have got the job done, as he has done his entire life. You know how to tell a man of integrity? It's when no one is looking. He's doing the right thing. That was Romney. How about another mumbling and incompetent Bush? Huh? How about another one of those? Will there be another Reagan who will talk libertarian while governing more like a European social democrat? Will they trot out another old war hero who will plunge us into war with Iran or take revenge on this country or that country, North Korea, China, or whoever, to divert our attention away from the economic morass government has placed us in? Oh, yeah, make no mistake, it wasn't you. It wasn't Europe. It was our government that caused it. It was our government, and we sucked the entire world down the hole with us. These are the likely alternatives if we cling to the fantasy that throwing the bums out at election time leads to something other than another group of slightly different bums. The fact is that the American people have been servants or slaves to their government since 1933. It wasn't always that way, of course, when the Adams administration enforced the Sedition Act that made criticism of the federal government illegal. Jefferson Madison responded with the Virginia and the Kentucky resolves of 1798, go back through your history, that clearly stated that the people did not intend to allow the enforcement of this unconstitutional law within those two states. They nullified it. Section 1 of Jefferson's Kentucky Resolve stated, for example, that the several states composing the United States of America are not united on the principles of unlimited submission to their general government. Other states supported Jefferson and Madison in their defense of free speech. What a novel idea. When President Thomas Jefferson imposed a national trade embargo and consummated the Louisiana Purchase, New Englanders, led by George Washington's Secretary of State, Timothy Pickering, loudly threatened to secede. They decided against it for practical economic and political reasons at the Hartford Secession Convention of 1814, but their actions did send a clear message to national politicians. Outraged by the embargo, the Massachusetts legislature use the language of Jefferson's own Kentucky Resolve to proclaim that the embargo was not legally binding on the citizens of the state, while denouncing the federal law as unjust, oppressive, and unconstitutional, and reminding President Thomas Jefferson that this state maintains its sovereignty and independence. All the New England states plus Delaware did exactly the same thing, and they nullified the embargo. These are very, very important pieces of history. They worked, and they worked without firing a shot. Why did they work? Because our government is set up that way. It's set up that way. It's designed that way. It's designed to allow the states to defend themselves against federal tyranny. When Alexander Hamilton, his Bank of the United States, now you remember that Alexander Hamilton was a big proponent of a national bank. Thomas Jefferson was not. He said, Hamilton said, basically, look, our country's broke, okay? We need to be able to raise money. We need to be able to extract money from the communities and coagulate it in one place so that we can have power, so that we can have money to do the national business. And it was the precursor to the Federal Reserve. It created 72% inflation in the first 5 years of its existence, and it corrupted politics with its politicized spending policies. Citizens all over the country assisted another president, a great president, President Andrew Jackson, in eventually destroying the institution. You'll remember. Well, maybe you don't remember, but if you go back to history, you'll remember. Andrew Jackson had a slogan, and it was very simple. Jackson and no bank. Jackson and no bank. Now, just to give you a really quick history lesson, what happened is that The heroic Ohio legislature slapped a $50,000 a year tax on each branch of this national bank, attempting to drive it out of business. The states have an equal right to interpret the Constitution for themselves, announced the Ohio legislature, and it decided that this national bank was not constitutional. Kentucky, Tennessee, Connecticut, South Carolina, New York, and New Hampshire followed suit. They sued the crap out of them. They taxed the crap out of them. And guess what happened? Well, you're exactly right. The Rothschilds threatened Jackson and said, if you do not approve the National Bank, I will order the Army of Britain to come back to your United States, and we will beat you into submission, and you will become a colony again. And that's exactly what he did. When the War of 1812 broke out, the New England states effectively seceded from the Union by refusing to participate. A proclamation by the Connecticut legislature was representative of the opinions of New Englanders. It must not be forgotten that the state of Connecticut is a free, sovereign, and independent state, that the United States are a confederated and not a consolidated republic, and that it was refusing to support the war. And guess what? The Rothschilds won. That's right. We lost the War of 1812. Now, the history books say that we won, of course. But you know why? Because the president agreed to allow the National Bank. And the war was over. When the 1828 Tariff of Abominations created an average tariff rate of 45%, applying mostly to northern manufactured goods, South Carolinians clearly understood that this was a pure act of political plunder at their expense. They convened a political convention to utilize the Jeffersonian idea of nullification and refused to collect the tariff. They even got the South Carolina legislature to allocate $160,000 for the purchase of firearms with which to fend off any would-be federal tax collectors. The result was that they forced the federal government to lower the tariff rate. During the 1850s, the middle states of New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, and New Jersey developed a very active secession movement that sought to either join a Southern Confederacy, form a Middle States Confederacy, or support Southern secession. Their overriding desire was to separate themselves from the imperious New England Yankees. When the Southern states seceded in 1860, also in the beginning of 1861, Abraham Lincoln pledged his everlasting support for Southern slavery in his first inaugural address, an address in which he endorsed a constitutional amendment, the Corwin Amendment, that would have forbidden the federal government from ever interfering with slavery. In the same speech, he promised a military invasion and bloodshed in any Southern state that ceased paying his beloved tariff or imports, which at the time accounted for more than 90% of the federal tax revenue. At that time, there was, of course, no federal income tax. The only way that they could get money was from tariffs. The average tariff rate had just been doubled by the Republican-controlled Congress. The Southern states, along with most people in the North, still held the Jeffersonian belief that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. And when that consent is withdrawn, the citizens have a duty to abolish the existing government and form a new one. Jefferson never wrote in the Declaration of Independence that the citizens have a duty to abolish the government and form a new one, as long as the other states all agree that you may do so. If the right of secession depends on someone else, on someone else's permission, then one does not have a right of secession. That was a fantasy invented by Lincoln, which he used to justify waging total war on his own country, murdering some 350,000 American citizens, including some 50,000 civilians. And that's a rough count. It could be more than that. From that time on, government in America was no longer for the people, by the people, of the people, as Chief Justice John Marshall once said in a phrase that was later plagiarized by Lincoln. From that time on, the purpose of government has been for those who run it to plunder those who do not. Nullification and secession were no longer tools after the war with which the citizens could control their own government. That was done. Reconstruction ended that, with the exception of Texas. They actually never signed on to that. The final nails in the coffin of government by consent were pounded in during the year 1913 with the advent of the federal income tax, the 16th Amendment. The creation of the Fed and the 17th Amendment calling for the direct election of U.S. senators. You'll remember before the 17th Amendment, U.S. senators were appointed by state legislatures. That meant that the people of the state would go to their state legislature and they would vote for two senators to send to Washington. It was a state election, and it was controlled by the state legislature. There were calls of crony capitalism and this kind of stuff, but it was on a state level, you understand. It wasn't on a national level. And so when the 17th Amendment was passed, senators could then run for election at large, which meant that they would campaign throughout the entire state, and they would get the votes directly from the people and not go through the state legislature. And what happened was it was instantly, within months, it became the one that had the most money won. Why? Because you could get your name out there. You could go reach all the people, and they would know your name, and they would vote for you. And if they didn't know your name, they wouldn't vote for you. And so the whole dynamic changed. It was originally designed by the constitutional designers that senators would be appointed by state legislatures. That was changed with the 17th Amendment. The direct income tax and the Fed gave the federal government the ability to do whatever it wanted to do, regardless of the Constitution, as even to wage undeclared wars. These vast riches were used to make millions of Americans totally subservient to the state, lest they lose their tiny government subsidies, and to bribe or threaten state governments to do whatever our masters in Washington, D.C. decree, lest they lose their cherished federal highway grants. The ability of the citizens to oppose the federal Leviathan by organizing political communities at the state and local levels was finally destroyed, and the centralized, monopolistic bureaucracy, that's what I call the agency government, rules America and much of the rest of the world today. And that's how it is. And there is a way around it, and we're going to talk about that this hour. Our phone lines, by the way, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. I'm sure you have an opinion on this. And by the way, that bribery isn't just at the high levels of government. Oh, no. We're not talking about millions of dollars only being paid to bankers or being paid to lawmakers or special projects of lawmakers back at their home states. We're not just talking about that. We're talking about wholesale buying of millions, tens of millions of votes. How do you do that? Well, I could tell you two simple ways. One is called a food stamp card. You give somebody $500, $600, $700 worth of food a month, and you give them a card where they can go buy the best brands and fill their freezer and their fridge and their table and have enough left over to send to their friends in other countries. And believe me, they do, by the barrel full, by the shipping container full. And you own them. They will do nothing. They will say nothing that will jeopardize that card. And there are now 61 million Americans that have those cards. 61 million people. That's almost half the voting force. Almost half the voting force. Completely owned by the federal government. You also do one other thing, and this is now finally being talked about in the news, is you decimate whole socioeconomic demographic sections of our people. In other words, right now the black family, only about 12 to 15% of births are in wedlock. That's horrendous. That is a complete wholesale destruction of the American black family. How did that happen? How did that happen? Is it because black men don't like black women? No. Is it because, black men make terrible fathers? Absolutely not. It has nothing to do with that. It is because, and only because, the federal government has replaced the black man as the breadwinner of the family. And the only way that the black mother can provide for their black children is to kick him out and to be a single mom. That's the way the government has set it up. That's the way they feed billions and billions of dollars into the black community every single year. They do it on purpose to destroy the integrity of the black family and to ensure themselves, ensure that they have at least 90% of the black vote anytime they snap their fingers. You want to talk about step and fetch? There's your step and fetch right there. That little plastic card. Yes, sir. I head right for the polls, sir. Exactly what I'm talking about. You just went from one slavery to another. If American citizens are to resist the rush to abominism, they must first give up on the fantasy that the Republican Party is anything but another cabal of crooks, con men, and clowns. They're just like the Democratic Party. Okay? It doesn't matter who wins. It's the same machine. The only realistic route to freedom, including a restoration of genuine free enterprise, is through the devolution of power away from Washington, D.C. And this is how it's done. No, I'm not talking about marching on Washington. Believe me, that's useless. The only thing you're going to get out of that is sore feet and your picture in some database. Forget about it. Washington, D.C. is not where the power is. Okay? Listen to me very, very closely. The power is in your state houses. Thomas Jefferson understood that democracy could never work in a country as large as the U.S., let alone one with more than 300 million people in it. And it won't work today. It has to be a republic. In January 29, 1804, a letter to Dr. Joseph Priestley, he wrote, "Whether we remain one confederacy or form into Atlantic and Mississippi confederacies, I believe not very important to the happiness of either part. Those of the Western Confederacy will be as much our children and descendants as those of the Eastern." On the topic of secession, Jefferson continued, "Did I now foresee a separation of some future day, yet I should feel the duty and the desire to promote the Western interests as zealously as the Eastern, doing all the good for both portions of our future family, which should fall within my power." When the New England Federalists were threatening secession, Jefferson wrote to his friend John C. Breckinridge on August 12, 1803, that if the New England seceded and created a second confederacy, God bless them both if it be for their good, but separate them if it is better. Unlike Lincoln, Jefferson did not believe in threatening bloodshed in the case of a separation or secession. He understood that such behavior would be a moral abomination and an unimaginable act of barbarianism. A civilized society does not wage total war on itself. As Jefferson described in the future citizens of a new state formed by an act of secession, he called them our children. Yet, it is Lincoln, not Jefferson, who portrayed by American court historians as a kindly, benevolent, and charitable angel. The Constitution long ago ceased placing any meaningful limits on governmental power. This social contract between the American people and their government was destroyed long ago by Hamiltonian nationalists. Americans now live under a series of dictators. Oh, we call them presidents. They're puppet dictators who all believe that they are essentially dictators of the world, capable of ordering the bombing of any place on earth without anyone's approval, ordering presidential planes grounded and searched. By the way, within weeks, Obama dipped his hands in blood by ordering a few bombs to be dropped in Pakistan. We are not at war with Pakistan, Mr. President. As of this writing, several dozen states have reportedly issued resolutions in support of the Jeffersonian principle of nullification. They call them sovereignty acts. Now, these will all be completely meaningless, and they are, unless the American public has the fortitude to actually enforce the resolutions and begin ignoring any and all federal government regulations that they interpret are constitutional and illegitimate. That is what the book Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty is all about. What the book lays out in very clear language in about 250 pages, you will understand it. It is a call to action. And the states have already done it. 40 states have already passed sovereignty acts. Now, obviously this is not nullification. That can't be done. But it's language of nullification. They're not actually saying, look, we're not going to enforce any federal regulations unless they're ratified by our legislature. That's nullification. But what they have done is they've essentially put up their dukes and they have dared the federal government to sue them. That's basically what they've done. Is it effective? Not really. Not really. But here's where it can be. Because these 40 states make up 80% of the states of the United States. And if you read the Constitution very carefully, it very clearly says 2/3 of the states are required to call a convention, and 3/4 of the states are required to ratify any amendments that are made. 80% is more than 75%, right? 75% is 3/4. Got it? You already have enough states. You already have enough governors. All they have to do is get together and say, wait a minute, folks. We 40 are more powerful than their 535. You understand what I'm saying? Those 40 governors are more powerful than all of Congress, all of the Senate, and the executive and judicial branches combined. They have the power. What they need is the book. Do you understand me? Get the book, Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty. Buy two copies and get one to your governor. I'm pleading with you. It can be done. If they read the book and realize that all they have to do is pick a state, I don't care. Meet in Salt Lake City, meet in Houston, meet in Cincinnati. It doesn't matter. Get those 40 governors together as representatives of their state, or send representatives. Pick two state senators from each state and send them to this convention. Declare the convention open. You have the authority to do so. And when you do, repeal those three amendments in the book. You have to get rid of the 17th Amendment. You have to get rid of the 16th Amendment. I'll explain those. The 16th Amendment is the amendment that allows the government to collect taxes from income. Repeal it. It's done. You understand? The IRS goes away. It's done. Repeal the 17th Amendment. That allows senators to run for election. End those elections. Return the senators to the state legislatures and let them be responsible to the local politics. We can do it now. Trust me. In those days, we couldn't communicate. There was no television. There was no radio. There was no smartphones. We didn't know what they were doing up in the state houses of our state. But we do now. We can watch it very closely. And all politics is local. If we keep up with what our senators are doing, we can make those changes instantly at our state legislature. And you understand, it's a completely different system. It's the way it was originally designed. You'll recall that our government is patterned after the House of Lords and the House of Commons. You got it? House of Lords is the Senate. House of Commons is the Congress. That's the pattern that they had. But those senators were originally appointed by the state legislatures. Now those senators run for election at large, and they propagandize, and they campaign, and they spend millions and millions and millions of dollars to win your election, and they go to Washington, and guess what they do? They stay there. 24, 30, 36 years, they stay there. And what do they do for the state? Nothing. They do nothing for the state. Mitch McConnell does absolutely nothing for the state of Kentucky. Rand Paul at least talks to the people in Kentucky. We communicate on a regular basis, back and forth. He makes a great effort at doing that. McConnell stays in Washington with one mission and one mission only, to get Obama out of office. It's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous, the political games that they play. End that once and for all. Get rid of Feinstein, and oh, it just goes on and on and on. Reed, and it's just crazy how political this gets. Everything the Congress does never even gets entertained in the Senate. And we're about to allow our borders to be torn down to the ground and highways to be built, and one nation from the northern stretches of Canada to the bottom of Mexico, one nation to be formed. By who? It's going to be formed by the Senate. Congress is going to have nothing to say about it. That immigration bill that Congress is going to pass will probably be a pretty good one. It'll talk about border security. It'll talk about walls. It'll talk about, you know, different paths to citizenship. And it'll be good. The Senate version will say, tear the wall down, both of them, the Canadian wall and the Mexican wall, and we're going to have one nation. And we're going to absorb the peso and the Canadian dollar, and we're going to make one coin, and it's going to be called the Amero or the whatever, and it's going to be one nation. You don't believe me? Go look at the map that Senator Feinstein just showed at one of her presentations. Go on. Go pull it up for yourself. You don't believe me? Look at the map. You know what it's called? It's not called America. It's not even called North America. You know what she called it in her presentation? She called it the homeland. And it went from the bottom of the Mexican Peninsula all the way to the north of Canada. The homeland. Get used to it, people. Your Senate is bringing it to you. Well, repealing the 17th Amendment, you'd get rid of that right away. And there are a few amendments to pass. You know, one of the problems that we've had since 1933 is the ability of the president to have unwarranted wars. I just talked to you about, well, actually, this last week, 15 people were killed in 3 days by drones in Yemen. They were our drones. We put them on an assassination list and we killed them. And we killed people in Pakistan all the time using these drones. Yeah, we get a few school children too, but that's okay. We get the bad guys. We're not at war with those countries. You understand? We have troops in Africa. Yeah, we're not at war with Africa. Not at all. But those troops are integrated into the communities, and they're training those people, and they're listening. They're setting up networks. We're not at war with them. The president, you know where he gets his troops? He gets them from your hometown. He takes your National Guard and deploys them wherever he wants to. And now we're losing more troops to suicide than we are to conflict. Why? Because those people signed up for the National Guard because of the posters. I want to help people during a flood. I want to help people after a tornado or a hurricane or a forest fire. I want to help in times of national disaster. I want to join the National Guard. I want that extra money. I don't mind giving up a couple weekends, a month, and 2 weeks in the summer. I want to serve my country, and I can do it locally in the National Guard. Wrong. Your National Guard was conscribed by the federal government, and your local boys were thrown into uniform and thrown into Afghanistan, and their minds were destroyed because they didn't sign up to kill or be killed. They didn't sign up to watch death of all kinds. They didn't sign up to make men obey. And when they came home, they couldn't deal with it. And so they ended themselves. One of those amendments is called the National Guard Amendment. And it returns the control of the National Guard to the state government, to the governor. And gives the governor the right to say no. When the president says, I need to take your Louisiana boys, I need to take your Montana sons, I need to take your Kansas daughters and mothers, and I'm going to send them to hell to fight for me, the governor can say, no, Mr. President. There's a constitutional amendment that says, I have control over our National Guard, and you're not taking our sons and daughters and sending them to your hell. You want to declare war, Mr. President? Then you raise your own army, and you go to Congress, and you get a declaration of war, and you do it, and we'll show up. But you're not taking our sons and daughters, and you're not going to send them to put bullets into people we are not at war with. And there are other amendments in there, meaningful ones, things that will fundamentally change the way the agencies work. It takes apart the Food and Drug Administration. It takes apart the Department of Transportation, the most corrupt department that ever existed on the face of the earth. An organization full of bribery and graft and fraud, unbelievable, trillions of dollars. It takes apart the Environmental Protectionist Agency. It takes apart the Department of Education. It takes apart every single agency, department, bureau, and administration, and returns it to a council of the states known as Congress. It removes the ability of private corporations to mint and control American money supply. It returns that right to the U.S. Treasury, where it belongs. The book can save our republic. You have to get it in the hands of your governor. It's called Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty. Buy two copies so you can read one and get one to your governor. 40 governors, one weekend, and we can change this forever. You understand that small groups of organized people are the only size of people that have ever made any changes in government. Do not march on Washington. I don't care if you go 1 million or 100 million strong. You will be defeated. You will be defeated, and you will lose everything. Don't go to Washington. It is pointless, it is meaningless, and you may die doing it. Don't do it. All you have to do is get the book in the hand of your governor. Tell him about the Constitutional Convention. These 40 governors can make the change. Citizens of every state should learn about the Second Vermont Republic, which for several years now has been laying the groundwork for Vermont to secede and once again become a free and independent republic, just as all the states thought of themselves as being prior to 1865. We are sovereign people. We are sovereign states, and we have a common mission, and that is to do business with one another, to have a peaceful relationship with one another. It is to do great things in the world. So think about this question. Should the law enforcement agencies have the power to write and enforce whatever laws they desire? That's what they are. That's what the agencies are. They write their own laws every day without your say, without the involvement of Congress or without the approval of the Senate. You are not represented in that government. You have no right to vote in that government. You don't know who those people are, and they don't want you to know who they are. And if you do find out who they are and you call them into Congress, they can sit there and take the Fifth Amendment, and they can hand you entire stacks of paper printed in black from border to border. And say, here, stick this black paper wherever you want. We're done here. The truth is that Congress passes an act known as a bill. When it is signed by the president, it becomes law. Who writes these bills? Well, certainly not Congress. These bills are written by professional writers assisted by lobbyists. Now, that's the truth. You see, a lobbyist is an expert in his own area of expertise. He has an agenda. He has something he wants to get done for the people that pay his paycheck. Congressmen are not usually experts at anything except looking and sounding good enough to get elected. Do they read the bills? Well, yes, if they are less than 10 pages. The larger bills, like the Affordable Health Care Act, are not even skimmed for content. There is no real debate. These kinds of bills are shoveled through to the president's desk, where he will sign it with much pomp and ceremony, with the right kind of witnesses and dozens of pens that'll be souvenirs for someone. Once the bill is law, then the secretary takes over. Who's the secretary? Ah, that's a great question. The secretary of each agency is actually a cabinet member, an appointee of the president. He chooses the secretary, and he pushes that person through to the office in that particular agency, whether it's the Secretary of Transportation, the Secretary of Education, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. You get it? Once that secretary is in position, he or she can be the interpreter of all new policies and interpretations of that law, you know, the one that Congress passed. The result is usually a barrel full of regulations that have the force of law. Our Constitution gives the Congress and only the Congress the power to create law. Nowhere in the Constitution that I am aware of does it give the Congress the power to delegate this authority to non-elected bureaucrats. Yet Congress does exactly that every single day. Not only do these regulations have the force to tax, to charge fees, confiscate properties and holdings of the citizens, they also have the complete impunity with respect to the real lawmakers, Congress. Over the years, our Congress has created, through new laws, a large number of alphabet soup enforcement agencies. The EPA, the TSA, the SEC, the FCC, the FDA, blah, 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 blah. What happens is this. Congress passes a new act or law, as well as laws that set up agencies to enforce the new act. Sometimes the enforcer is assigned to an already existing agency. Then, because the Congress does not have the technical expertise to write the regulations that will be necessary to implement their new law, they delegate the power to write the regulations. That's where the rubber meets the road. Okay? These have the force of law to the designated enforcement agency. And voila, we have law enforcement agencies writing the laws they will then enforce. You have no say. There is no debate. There's no representation. This is tyranny, pure and simple. This is how unelected bureaucrats such as those in the EPA can write law that wasn't necessarily intended by the Congress, your elected official. We see it all the time, every day. A good example, Are the recent new regulations being promulgated by the EPA to control carbon emissions from power generating plants that effectively will enforce carbon cap and trade law that the Congress has in fact already rejected? In fact, every nation in the world has rejected it. Why? Because it is a corrupt system of currency generation. So what should be done about this travesty? Well, the power to write regulations should be stripped from every one of these enforcement agencies. It can be. If you get the book Alienated Nation into the hands of your governor, that will happen immediately. When regulations are required to implement a law passed by Congress, Congress should outsource the job of writing the necessary regulations to one or more private consulting firms that do have the necessary expertise, that don't have a dog in the fight, and then they will answer to Congress. Congress should then have to review the work, product of the contracted consultants with the help, if necessary, of other third-party experts like me and others. In due course, approve the regulations that the enforcement agencies are empowered to enforce. That's it. It's so simple. It's so clean. It actually will work. You might say this will be a slow and cumbersome process, and you know what? It probably should be. It probably should be, because we're seeing something like between 200 and 1,200 new regulations a month. No industry can respond to that kind of work, that endless onslaught of changes and costs that we have to go through. Our industry is innovative in the sense that we're constantly coming up with safety ideas and efficiency ideas. And when we come up with those ideas, it's on our own. It's to make a better product. It's to make something safer for the American people to drive or the world community to drive. Guess what happens? The Department of Transportation jumps all over, turns it into a regulation, and now it's required for everyone. And guess what? They get a fringe benefit. They can now subpoena that information into court and use it to beat the heck out of insurance companies. Well, there you go. Those are my thoughts. They're powerful, they're poignant, and they're timely. Please, people, alienatednation.com, get the book, buy two copies, and take one to a campaign office of your congressman. Take it to a campaign office of your senator. Take it to the office of the governor. Hand carry it, unwrapped. Let them inspect it. Say it's a gift. Say it's a gift from you, from me. I don't care. Get it in the hands of the governor. You have to do this. We have to call this constitutional convention. It must take place. The call to action is now. I won't see you next week here on X Squared Radio. I will be traveling. But I will see you in 2 weeks right back here at X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of our program tonight. Remember that you are Source. Look for the good in others and help it to grow a little bit every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. Thank you very much. And we'll see you in 2 weeks right here at X Squared Radio.
Thank you.